Hi, friends. How are we doing? I'm glad you came to church today, and I'm grateful all of you for joining us online as well. This weekend, we continue a four-part series we're calling One Another, in which we're talking about spiritual friendship. What are we laughing at? Oh, there was. Well, that'll make sense in a little bit. That would make you laugh, wouldn't it? I'm like, what are you, giving me a complex up here, people? We'll bring Eric back, okay? Good night. The journey with Jesus was never meant to be done alone. We're created for community. We're wired for relationship. But just not any relationship. We desperately need spiritual friends. Friends who love God and love us. Friends who help us pay attention to God. Friends who help us find strength in God. Now, today we're going to consider an aspect of spiritual friendship that many of you want to ignore. In fact, the facet of friendship we'll discuss may be the reason some of you have pulled away from spiritual friendship. Well, today, I'm going to ask you to reconsider. Before I do, let's ask God for his help. Will you pray with me? Lord, I pray today, through the Bible, you might cast a compelling vision to us of your intention for friendship. Lord, inspire us to forge the kind of friendships we talk about today. Rouse us to be the kind of friends we talk about today. We pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. Amen. What's the scariest thing in your bathroom? See where this is going? Well, in case you didn't know, you should be terrified. Did you know approximately 200,000 serious bathroom injuries occur in the United States each year? Statistics show 1 in 6,500 Americans will be injured by a toilet seat during their lifetime. Most will be men. Did you know every time you dry off with a towel, dead skin cells cling to its surface, providing protein to feed microorganisms such as Staphylococcus aureus, which can cause infection and pustules? Did you know even the clean towel you use tonight will be crawling with microorganisms come morning? Now, most accidents that occur in the bathroom are burns or falls or electric shocks, but accidents are not likely to be what you fear most. If you're anything like me, the microbes thriving on the towel down the hall may not leave you sleepless at night. For you, perhaps the scariest thing in your bathroom is the bathroom scale. The reason you fear your scale, the reason you hate your scale, is because your scale tells you the truth. Friends, did you know scales at doctor's offices are calibrated automatically to add 5 pounds to your weight? Now, that's not true, but some of you just got your hopes up, didn't you? When you go to your doctor's office and the nurse instructs you to step on your scale, you pause to remove all excess clothing and jewelry because your flip-flops clearly add 8 pounds. Then when the number displays, you comment, that's not what my scale says at home. Of course, your nurse diligently makes note of this in your chart for the record. We hate a scale because a scale tells the truth. It conveys the reality of our condition. In spite of how we feel, in spite of what we want to hear. But what if the thing we hate the most is the thing we need the most? A scale is a truth teller. You may want to tuck it under your bed so that it's out of sight, but maybe you should move it into your kitchen. Today, we're talking about having a truth teller in your life. Today, we're talking about being a truth teller in the life of the people around you. When we study the Bible as a whole, we see motifs, recurring themes that run throughout the Bible from cover to cover. And one of them shows up near the beginning. In Leviticus 19, verse 18, we read, "Love your neighbor as yourself." Now, this idea is woven like a brightly colored thread through the tapestry of the Bible. We often ponder its beauty, reflecting on how love might reveal itself through a friend's compassion or kindness or gentleness or patience. Now, as we ponder those facets of spiritual friendship, we should never forget the command that immediately precedes it. Leviticus 19, verse 17, rebuke your neighbor frankly. Here's the point. Sometimes love confronts. Now, when love confronts, it doesn't nag or nitpick. It doesn't shame or blame. Love brings truth with compassion and kindness and gentleness and patience. But this may be the number one reason you are avoiding spiritual friendship in this season. Maybe you want to go your own way and live your own life without any accountability, without anyone tapping you on the shoulder. But my friend, what if the thing you hate most is the thing you need most? What if the thing you need most right now is an honest, life-giving rebuke? One of the greatest gifts God gives us is candid, caring friends who aren't afraid to tell us the truth. And when we surround ourselves with wise friends, God often speaks to us through them. There's an axiom we use around Capital a lot. I think it best sums up the point of this message. Most of you have heard it because I say it all the time, but it's been years since I've built a whole message around it. It's one of the most important insights you'll ever grasp about spiritual friendship and life in general. Here it is. Grace without truth isn't love. Grace without truth isn't love. When I set out to teach this series on spiritual friendship, there was a particular passage that I felt I absolutely had to include. To be sure, its message is timeless. However, in this season, I think its truth is timely. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24. Let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds. Okay, let's carefully look at a few of these words. The writer of Hebrews says, let's consider. Well, if you didn't know, the New Testament was originally written in Greek. The verb consider is the Greek word katanoeo. And katanoeo means to examine in a reflective manner. It means to contemplate. Now look back at the verse. The writer of Hebrews says, let's consider, let's put some serious thought into how we may spur one another on in faith. By the way, BT Dubs, spur is not a calm word. In Greek, it's the word paroxysmos. Paroxysmos is an expression of intensity. It means provoke. In other contexts, it means to irritate. Now, don't misunderstand me. This verse is not a license to be a jerk for Jesus, but it is a command to confront when necessary. When we think about God's plan for our spiritual relationships, we must never forget, grace without truth isn't love. In biblical community, the follower of Jesus has a responsibility to his or her brothers and sisters to speak truth with love. And we have a shared responsibility to hold one another accountable. Here's how Paul says it to another church in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14. We urge you, brothers and sisters, warn those who are idle and disruptive. Encourage the disheartened, help the weak, be patient with everyone. Make sure that nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always strive to do what is good for each other and for everyone else. Now ponder the picture painted by the apostle of spiritual friendship in the church. It involves both encouragement and accountability. Faith in King Jesus is designed to be lived out within a community where you can be encouraged and helped and warned. The ancient sages said it well in Proverbs 27, verse 17, as iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. Now, theoretically, this sounds like a great idea. We imagine surrounding ourselves with mentors who will coach us on becoming better leaders, teach us to make more money, slide us tips about becoming a better spouse or a better parent. And it sounds delightful. Sometimes it is delightful. But usually it hurts. It hurts to be sharpened. When you sharpen a knife, there's friction. That friction is what sharpens the knife. But does anybody think how the knife feels about it? It's probably not pleasant for the sharpener either. No, it's not easy to hear truth about oneself. In our minds, we've created a version of reality, a version of who we are and who we aren't, and we go to great lengths to protect that self-concept. But the truth is, we're often blinded by our need to feel good about ourselves. We're blinded by our need to be right, to be the best. Maybe you struggle with pride and you don't know it. Maybe you've latched on to a destructive habit that's changing you and you can't see it. Maybe you have an attitude, a weakness, a blind spot that is preventing you from thriving, but you'll never recognize it unless someone comes up to you and points it out. Friends, the greatest gift your friend can give, the greatest gift you may ever give your friend, may be a simultaneously gentle but jolting, life-giving rebuke. Because grace without truth isn't love. Is there anyone in your life to whom you've given grace but withheld truth? It may be someone close to you. A spouse, a parent, a roommate. God often speaks his truth through his people. Maybe one of the reasons your friend isn't hearing God's voice is because your lips are zipped. I recently told you about one of my favorite professors to whom I owe an enormous debt. And back in college, she was a professor of homiletics. Homiletics is the art of preaching. And she was the first person to teach me about public communication. And I'll tell you, she was an amazing orator in her own right. I recall the many times I listened to her sermons, marveling at her craft, while simultaneously experiencing the personal presence of God's Spirit, applying the truth of the Bible to my life. Oh, I wish you could hear her. She talked like this. She didn't sound like a preacher with bombast and verbosity. But every time she spoke at our campus chapel, the room would be packed with students who would hang on her every word. She excelled as a preacher. She excelled as a teacher. I watched this gifted woman make some of the most monotonous information come to life again and again in the classroom. She could take the most tedious, mind-numbing facts about the most from the most tedious textbooks and make the words leap off the page. I don't know how she did it. But her best work was teaching about teaching. She handed us, her students, a clear and concise pattern for writing engaging messages. She taught about expository sermons and textual sermons and topical sermons. She delineated between exegesis, application, and illustration, showing every sermon needs just the right amount of each. She'd say, class, follow the rules until you're good enough to break the rules. But she had a gentle way of reminding a room full of 20-year-olds you're not good enough yet. She believed, you could learn something from every communicator. I remember her talking about her observation of one famous preacher whose name most of you would know. She said, make no mistake, he's boring. When I see him on television, I could leave the TV on, go into the kitchen, make a snack, eat the snack, slowly make my way back to the living room, knowing I didn't miss a thing. Yet she countered, he may be boring, but he's simple. We'd leave her classes ready to save the world with our sermons. But she knew we were eager preachers with more passion than practice. So to spare those who would eventually hear our messages, she'd remind us, if you can't be good, at least you can be short. But I'll tell you, one of the greatest lessons I learned from her was how to deliver difficult truth with grace. She could bring correction and encouragement in the same sentence. And friends, I desperately needed both. In one section of homiletics, we would write sermons and then deliver them in class to her and to our fellow classmates. And I tell you, her homiletics courses saw some of the greatest disasters in the history of Christendom, okay? It was bad. After a student delivered a sermon, she would come to the podium to bring feedback. And I tell you, this woman had a gift of saying something inspiring to every young preacher that she trained. I don't know how she did it. But then she followed those comments by gently pointing out a sermon's shortcomings. Now, I don't know what her secret was, but she would do it in such a way the student would never feel any pain, never feel embarrassed, and the whole class learned from the experience. Clearly, she put intentional effort into learning how to speak truth with love. Now, she did it because she believed in us. She did it because she trusted God might use her words and her wisdom to shape us and mold us and someday impact people in pews around the world. But ultimately, she learned how to bring encouraging correction because she loved us. And she knew grace without truth isn't love. And God's people have a responsibility to deliver both. In James chapter 5, verse 19, the apostle writes, my brothers and sisters, if one of you should wander from the truth and someone should bring that person back, remember this, whoever turns a sinner from the error of their way will save them from death and cover over a multitude of sins. In this passage, James is using the metaphor of life as a journey. And he speaks of someone who goes astray, someone who veers from God's path to forge their own. There are many reasons people wander. People wander when God doesn't live up to their expectations, when God disappoints them. People wander when God's way appears less profitable, when God's way starts to cramp their style. People wander when they fall in love with someone who isn't on the same path. We've seen it again and again. James says, if one of you should wander. Now, I think I could argue one of the most important words that James uses in this verse is one of the most overlooked. In this translation, it shows up in those English words, one of you. But it's actually a single word in Greek. It's the little word, tis. It simply means someone or anyone. You ask, what's the big deal? It's a banal and boring indefinite pronoun. Troy, why do you put special attention on that word? Because its regularity should warn us. Here's the point. Anyone can wander. Anyone can wander. Your mother, your brother, The follower of Jesus who led you to Jesus? The pastor who pastored you through childhood? Anyone can wander from the truth. Maybe you have a loved one who loved Jesus, but doesn't really love him anymore. Friend, maybe through this message, God is inviting you to trust him and begin a conversation with him with compassion, kindness, gentleness, and patience. I think of my preaching professor. Only a handful of people have directly impacted my present day ministry like that woman. But anyone can wander. My preaching professor was recently released from a state penitentiary where she was serving time for the attempted murder of her lover's spouse. Anyone can wander. Look, I had no idea she was wandering. I'm sure it didn't happen overnight. It was a series of choices, a sequence of decisions. I had no idea she was veering from the path. I wasn't close enough. But I bet someone was. Maybe they warned her. If they loved her enough, I'm sure they did. Because, friends, love isn't afraid to go there. Even if the conversation is uncomfortable, even if the conversation is agonizing, love isn't afraid to go there because love knows the consequences if it doesn't. James says, my brothers and sisters, if one of you should wander from the truth and someone should bring that person back, literally turn that wayward friend back to God, James says, remember this, whoever turns a sinner from the error of their way will save them from death and cover over a multitude of sins. Now, when a fellow believer is used by God to redirect a wanderer, he or she saves them from death. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that we save them in the same way God saves them. But it does say something about the priority God places on our partnership with him. Have you ever been a part of the process of turning a wayward son or daughter back to Jesus? I'm telling you, you can make $1 billion. You can climb the corporate ladder, you can climb Mount Everest, but you can't take any of that with you when you die. The only thing you can take with you is people. The only thing you can drag with you into eternity is a friend. James says, when we turn a wayward follower around, we cover over a multitude of sins. Now, this doesn't mean we shove their sin under a rug. It's an ancient Hebrew metaphor for atonement. Now, throughout the Bible, God does the saving. God does the covering. But here in the final words of James's letter, we see there's a sense in which we do too. At least we could. If we would. Well, there's one more word I'd like to highlight from James's letter, and it's by far one of the most important words in the text. It shows up in verse 19. It's that word, someone. If someone should wander, then someone should bring them back. And you might have guessed it. It's that lackluster word, teas. Yeah, anyone can wander, but anyone can turn a wanderer. You don't have to have a degree in theology. You don't have to have an official ministry title. You don't have to have an official anything. Remember, James isn't writing to pastors. He's writing to people like the person sitting next to you. You can turn a wanderer from the error of her ways. But the question is, how? How do we do this? Do we bury them under a load of evangelical guilt? Do we beat them around the ears with Bibles? Well, to answer that question, I want to take you to one of Paul's letters. Because in Galatians 6, Paul fills in a few gaps. Chapter 6, verse 1. Paul writes, brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. Okay, just like James, the apostle Paul calls them brothers and sisters, reminding them they're part of a family. You go out of your way for your brothers and sisters. You work harder to preserve the relationship with your brothers and sisters. You feel more obligated to help your brothers and sisters. Paul says, we're brothers and sisters. We're family. Now, Paul identifies the qualifications of the restorer. They don't have to be a pastor, but they should be someone who lives by the Spirit. Earlier in the letter to the church at Galatia, Paul writes in chapter 5, verse 16, "So I say, walk by the Spirit," or live by the Spirit, "and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh." Now, what does it mean to live by the Spirit or walk by the Spirit? What's that look like? He tells us in verse 22, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Those are the kinds of people who do the turning. Now, we'd be wrong to assume Paul's talking about perfect people. He's not looking for the perfect. He's looking for the spiritual. Back to verse 1, brothers and sisters, if someone's caught in sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. To restore means to put something back in order. It means to return it to its proper place. Literally in Greek, you should restore that person in the spirit of gentleness. Sometimes this word is translated meekness. Meekness is a deliberate exercise of the will in which one responds with gentleness and humility instead of using power for selfish ambition or self-aggrandizement or for retaliation. See, a meek person isn't overbearing or arrogant. The meek show their strength comes from God, not a self-attained spirituality. Here's the point. There's no room for holier-than-thou Christians in the restoration process. Okay? Believers who pride themselves in the spiritual accomplishments, and their spiritual accomplishments, will only derail the redemption. A wandering disciple is not helped by a spiritual know-it-all who thinks he's God's gift to God, okay? A wandering disciple needs the humble admonition of a peer who understands and empathizes. A wanderer needs a friend who's concerned, who's not concerned about showing off their spiritual prowess, but a friend who makes the process solely about the well-being of the wanderer. Paul adds a warning to his words later in verse 1, "But watch yourselves," he says, "or you also may be tempted." Now, the restorer who lives by the Spirit is responsible, A, to restore the wayward friend, but B, to guard her own life, his own life and conduct. This warning may refer to the particular sin of the wanderer, or it may also just be a warning against the sin of pride. Now, then, Paul offers the wisdom we read just 2 weeks ago. Verse 2, "Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you'll fulfill the law of Christ." See, understand, bringing truth, helping someone turn back to God is one of the most important ways we can carry one another's burdens. Now, as I talk about this, I recognize not everyone's going to listen. Not everyone will turn. Some will keep running. Some will snap back at you for sticking your nose in their business. But do you love them enough to risk that response? Do you love them enough to go there? Because grace without truth isn't love. On 4 different occasions over almost 20 years of serving as Capital's lead pastor, 4 different colleagues loved me enough to bring me a difficult truth. "Troy, your zipper's down." Now, I'm sure it was awkward for them, especially because they were all women. But love isn't afraid to go there. And grace without truth isn't love. Of course, the truth you may need to bring to a friend may be even more difficult to convey. Say, for example, you have a friend who's a really great gal, but you've begun to suspect she's developing a drinking problem. Should you say something? Should you begin the conversation? Most of you know, it's harder than it looks. Few of us enjoy confrontation, but it's an important part of the community of Jesus, and confrontation is inseparable from love. Is it possible that your decision not to confront a brother or sister could harm them? What if the thing they need most right now is an honest, life-giving truth-teller? Look, I know some of us have trouble bringing negative feedback. Maybe you're conflict averse. Maybe you're something of a peacemaker. And hear me, God wired you as a peacemaker. It's a wonderful personality trait. I do find, however, that those of us who are peacemakers often have difficulty being truth tellers. It's not that we lie, it's that we hold back. We don't say everything that needs to be said. And then when we say something, if we say something, we don't always say it well. We water it down past the point of comprehension. Or we bottle it up and surprise people with our pent-up intensity. But what if we got good at being truth-tellers? Gracious truth-tellers. Here's a proverb we've seen before, Proverbs 27, verse 5. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. One of the greatest gifts God gives is loving, honest friends who aren't afraid to tell us the truth. And see, the wounds of verse 6 are not those inflicted by sin. In the Proverbs, we look to the parallel phrase in verse 5 to find its meaning. The wounds of verse 6 refer to the words of rebuke. Words that might be difficult to hear, but words we desperately need to hear. They hurt, but they don't harm. Okay? Now, this proverb doesn't command us to confront every sin that we see in our friends. Please don't. The scriptures bring balance. Elsewhere in the Proverbs, it's our glory to overlook an offense. Peter says love covers over a multitude of sins. Paul says love keeps no record of wrongs. Understand, only the spiritually immature feel the need to confront everyone for every sin. But sometimes love confronts. I know a few self-proclaimed truth tellers who make truth telling about themselves. They're not pointing out people's flaws because they love them. They're pointing them out because they're annoyed with them. And that's not love. See, friends, it's essential we have patience with one another. We're all people in process. However, true love sometimes requires confrontation. Hidden love in the text refers to the actions of someone who thinks he's being loving by hiding the truth. Someone who thinks she's showing love by not confronting. How often have we said, I love her too much to tell her the truth. But what we really mean is, I love myself too much to deal with the drama. We sacrifice truth on the altar of relational peace. Now note, in the parallel clause of Proverbs 27, 5 and 6, hidden love is compared to the deceptive kiss of the enemy. It's just that bad. But see, love isn't afraid to go there. And though in the moment, you may not feel like you want to go there, or you want someone to go there with you, I'm telling you, you got to be a truth teller and you got to get a truth teller who will, because you desperately need to be loved, and grace without truth isn't love. Grace without truth isn't love. Here's a key takeaway about spiritual friendships from James 5, from Galatians 6, from the other texts we've gone over. In the case of both the Apostle James and the Apostle Paul, they believe it is the responsibility of the believer to pastor the believer. Now let me repeat that. It is the responsibility of the believer to pastor the believer. You probably noticed, Paul didn't call upon church leaders to do the restoring. James didn't ask the elders to govern the process. They looked to every brother and sister in King Jesus. Now, here's what that means for us today. My dear friends, I need your help. Our little church outgrew me a long time ago. I can't keep up with everybody. Every week I meet someone for the first time who's attended Capitol for months and months. And I hate every second of that because I wish I could be in all of your lives all the time. It'd be great. We'd been watch shows together. We'd do it. It'd be great. But I can't be there to carry your burdens or binge watch your shows. That means that somebody in our community may drop off my radar without me or the church staff ever knowing it, or perhaps finding out too late. I need you. See, friends, we have to grow larger and smaller at the same time. While we grow numerically as a community, we must grow in personal relationships, forming accountable relationships in which we share this journey with one another. Let me get practical. Can you think of anybody in our community you haven't seen in a while? Now give it a minute. Think of somebody? Why not give them a call to check in? Why not pop an email or a text to see how they're doing? Now hear me. I am not hereby deputizing the church police. Oh, good night. Don't interrogate people. Where were you on the morning of August 28? Sleeping in? How would you feel if Jesus slept in? Good night. No, we got to keep it cool, okay? Remember, compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, right? And always, don't make assumptions, just love. Now of course, as I ask you to help me, you may protest. Troy, it would mean so much more if you called them. Granted, there are some occasions in which that might be the case, but not normally. I had a chat with a pastor friend of mine to get his opinion. He agreed wholeheartedly. It usually means more when someone from within the church contacts them. See, when I contact them, I'm just doing my job. When I contact them, I run the risk of heaping on that aforementioned evangelical guilt we talked about, right? But when you call them, it just shows someone cares. It reminds them that they have someone in this community who's concerned about the trajectory of their life. Could such a conversation open a can of worms? You betcha. Could such a conversation stretch you, causing you to seek wise counsel, read a book, pray harder? You betcha. But remember this, whoever turns a sinner from the error of their way will save them from death and cover over a multitude of sins. I'm just telling you, I think it's worth it. Pray with me. Lord, we come to you and we got to pray this prayer in two different directions today. First, I pray for those of us who have walled ourselves off from spiritual friendship because we really don't want truth tellers in our lives. We don't want somebody tapping us on the shoulder. We don't want someone looking over our shoulder. We want to do life our way. We want freedom. We know best. Lord, I pray for the man or the woman, the teen, the child. If they're in that space, I pray that you open their eyes to see that is actually not a good way to go at all. No, we don't need to invite legalistic, finger-pointing, judgmental Christians into our space. But what if we could bring life-giving, God-honoring, gracious, gracious truth-tellers into our lives, whom we could invite to peek over our shoulder and coach us, counsel us, teach us, train us, correct us when necessary? What if we can have the humility in which we receive that, Lord, I pray that for every person in this room. Give us the faith to cultivate that aspect of spiritual friendship in the days ahead. Lord, help us to catch a vision for what that might look like this fall. If we spend the next 4 months of the year cultivating spiritual friendship, how might that change 2023? Give us the faith to find truth tellers. And Lord, give us the faith to be truth tellers. Maybe as we were talking, Lord, I bet people came to mind. Truths we need to tell, people we need to contact. Lord, help us to become people of faith who courageously reach out, not with arrogance, not with spiritual superiority, but with gentleness, with curiosity, with great, great love. Give us the bravery to do that this week. In fact, help us to get to a point where we just trust you. And when somebody comes on our heart, we stop what we're doing and we pray. Maybe we stop what we're doing and we reach out and tell them we're praying. Whatever that looks like. Lord, help us to see this beautiful, beautiful vision of spiritual friendship that you want for all of us. Lord, I've been praying it for months. I'll pray it again today. I pray that every person in this room, every person watching this online, over the next several months can cultivate 2 or 3 BFFs, close spiritual friends, within this community. Lord, I pray that in the name of King Jesus. And wait a minute. I also want to pray for the person who's here today, who's wandering. I want to pray for the person who's just pulled back from you and from your people. But they came on a whim. Maybe they came at the invitation of a friend. Maybe they're watching online because someone sent them the link. Lord, help them to realize this moment is your invitation to turn back. Help them to realize they don't have to clean their act up before they turn. All they need to do is turn. They can't earn your grace, they just turn toward it. That's it. That's it. And help them to realize that you, in your grace, by your Spirit, are drawing them, even now. This is your invitation. I pray they take you up on it and turn. When they do, may they experience your unceasing love. I pray this in the name of the King who came to us full of grace and truth. Amen. All right, we got some homework to talk about. And friends, it's particularly important today, so stay with me, okay? Don't check out. Here's your first assignment. Find a gracious truth teller. I recommend have as many of these as you can get. Prayerfully consider who might spur you on toward love and good deeds. Let me ask you, has anybody brought you a difficult truth about yourself in the last 30 days? If you're viewing online, you don't know what just happened, but there was a little bit of a, I don't know if it was excitement or protest in front of me, but there's a pretty good group of spiritual friends sitting right in front of me. And they ain't afraid to speak truth to one another, but they're also not afraid to give grace to one another. Am I right, ladies? And so that's why it works. See, gracious truth tellers. Have you had anybody speak a difficult truth to you? I'm saying outside of your career, outside of a 360 degree review, I'm talking about somebody speaking truth to you about your love of God and your love of others, about your faith, about your fear, about your anger, about your impatience. Okay? Now, if not, it's possible you didn't need any feedback. But it's also possible that you have walled yourself off from it by avoiding it, deflecting it, debating it, and rationalizing it. In the name of our King, knock it off. And instead, seek it out. Pursue it and prize it, and you'll be counted among the wise. Okay? Find a gracious truth teller. Secondly, become a gracious truth teller. Prayerfully consider how you might spur someone on toward love and good deeds. Prayerfully consider how you might inspire someone toward love and good deeds. Now, if you do this, you got to check your ego at the door. There's no need to win. There's no need to be right. I told you so's are gone, okay? And whatever you do, make sure the person knows deep in their bones that you love them, okay? Henry Cloud contends the amount of truth a relationship can handle is proportional to the amount of perceived love that's present. Now, of course, when you become a gracious truth teller in someone's life, you may need to brace yourself for their reaction, okay? It may be wise to expect a little drama. And in fact, I recommend preparing yourself. Here's a book for you. It's called Crucial Conversation. Some of you have read it. Now, remember the passage in Hebrews 10? Remember the passage in Hebrews 10? It didn't just say spur one another on. It says, let's consider. Let's carefully deliberate, cogitate, and meditate on how we might spur one another on. See, you might need to go to school on how to do this. Okay? This is a book that'll help you to consider how to have a difficult conversation. Here's another one. How to Have That Difficult Conversation by Henry Cloud and John Townsend. I love this book. The dedication reads, to all who seek to make truthful conversations a central part of all their relationships. Okay? Two incredible books. Pick them up. Go to school. Consider how you might spur one another on. Now, I'm going to go a little different direction in our homework, okay? Now, I'm going to challenge you to make coming to church a habit in this season. Earlier, I took you to the book of Hebrews, right? Where we read in verse 24 of chapter 10, let's consider how we might spur one another on toward love and good deeds, right? Now, the forceful verb spur is modified in the sentence by two participial phrases that come in the next verse. In other words, the following two phrases hand us the necessary conditions for spurring one another on. Let's read it again in verse 24. Let's consider how we might spur one another on toward love and good deeds. First, not giving up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing. Second, but encouraging one another. Okay, the second phrase offers us the word encouraging. And I love that word. It means to exhort. It means to instill someone with courage or comfort or cheer. I love that word, and I'll tell you all about it next week in next week's message, okay? But I'll summarize the point by pleading with you. You desperately need people who do this in your life, especially in seasons of suffering and especially in seasons of failure. But too often, in these dark times, we pull away from community. We isolate ourselves working on our problem in our own way, in our own strength. Well, the problem is that takes us out of community when we need community the most. I've seen it again and again. When someone loses their job, they're tempted to withdraw from community out of embarrassment. They don't know how to answer the question, what do you do for a living? Or how's the job hunt coming? Or when someone's marriage falls apart, they're tempted to stop coming to church because that's something they did with their spouse. Maybe they don't want to face the questions. Maybe they don't want people to feel sorry for them. Now, their pain is real and raw. And if their pain feels familiar, I'm not going to tell you to simply get over it. But I am going to invite you to entrust that pain and entrust that fear to the God who calls you to community, who's created you for community. I'm telling you, the worst way to deal with failure is to deal with it alone. The worst way to deal with fear is to deal with it alone. The worst way to deal with divorce is to deal with it alone. Everybody hear me. The author of Hebrews says, don't give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing. Imagine making it a little awkward in the room. Some of us are out of the habit of meeting together. Actually, we're in the habit of not meeting together. We've developed a different set of habits, and that's become especially prominent. That's become an especially prominent habit since the pandemic. Am I right? So many people just kind of got out of the habit. I understand. This is going to sound like the pastor is saying you need to come to church. And I guess the pastor's saying you need to come to church. But not to stroke my ego so we can have a big crowd that I can preach to. Please don't. That doesn't matter. None of that matters. I just want you to experience and cultivate spiritual friendship in your life. The life in Jesus was meant to be done together in Jesus. So let's break some old habits and develop some new ones. Sound good? Make coming to church a habit this season. Here's another assignment. Invite someone to come to church with you. Here's a corollary to that assignment. Invite someone to come back to church with you. Seriously, let God speak to you this week. Maybe ask him, Lord, who do you want me to invite? Who do you want me to talk to in the next week or two? And again, no pressure, no legalism. Please, friends, I mean that. You hear me? If you use shame to get someone back to church, you're not helping. You're doing the devil's work. Everybody hear me? Doesn't help. But gently invite someone to come and sit with you and take them to lunch. Take them to dinner if it's a Saturday service afterward, okay? Now, I want to give you something to invite them to. And this announcement is about 2 years overdue. In 2 weeks, we will begin a series that we call God and the Movies. If you're new to our community, this is a series we do from time to time, in which we use some of Hollywood stories to illustrate God's story with us. Each week we'll take a different movie and a different text from the Bible and invite God to speak. Now, I want you to bring a friend with you. Over the years, we found this series to be a memorable and meaningful way to share the message of Jesus. I know several of you attended Capitol for the first time during a movie series, and maybe your friend or loved one will be next, okay? So that starts 2 weeks from today. Stand with me. Here's a verse for you for the week, Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24. I think I read it 29 times in this message, so I won't read it again. But the image on your screen is available for you to download along with the graphic that follows. You can look for them on our website and from our social media accounts. If you came with a need, we'll have some people waiting there at the front to pray for you. And friends, take us up on this. Take us up on this. If something snapped loose this week or this month, or your heart's a little unsteady, or you got a friend with a really big need and you'd like someone else praying for him, stick around, make your way up to the front, invite him to pray. If you're viewing this online, anytime, and this goes for all of you, anytime today or during the week, send us an email, care@capitalchurch.com, because we've got a team of people who want to pray for you, okay? Now, this is what I want to pray for all of you today. May God give you the gift of life-giving truth tellers who love God and love you so much they're not afraid to tell you to get your junk together. And they're not afraid to help you get your junk together. And likewise, may God give you the courage to become a life-giving truth teller who inspires your spiritual friends with grace and truth. Thanks for coming today. Grace and peace.